Start the program, is it? No. Good evening, Truth Seekers. Mike Malloy here. Thanks for tuning in. And welcome to tonight's program. We have a whole bunch of nonsense for you tonight. And some of it not really nonsensey at all. Some of it pretty good stuff. I wanted to start with an email from Daryl from last night. Daryl's in Montgomery, Alabama. And he writes, Mike, thanks for having Governor Siegelman on. See, Daryl's from Montgomery. Siegelman was the former governor. Daryl writes, there are so many facets to the Siegelman saga that are Kafkaesque, as you pointed out. What Governor Siegelman didn't tell you is that his home was broken into several times. In fact, Siegelman told his family to just assume that their house is bugged. On the weekend that Don Siegelman was dragged off to prison in shackles, his lawyer's offices were broken into. Combine this with the emails between several of the jurors and prosecutors, and you have one hell of a movie. Only it's not a movie. It's real. If I had not lived here and watched a lot of this happen, I would not have believed it myself. I hope the Supreme Court does take up his case. If they do not, or if they rule against Governor Siegelman, it really is time to get out of Dodge. Daryl in Montgomery. You know, I was thinking about that too, Daryl. The circumstances of what has happened to this truly decent man. I mean, he really is, and what has happened to him. I hate to be picayune here or trivialize anything, but seriously, it would make one hell of a movie. It's one of those films that people would go into thinking, "Oh, hey man, let's go see," and they would come out thinking, "I'll be damned." I'll be damned. This happened in my country? And what better way to get the message out? We have a friend who's a screenwriter, lives out in Seattle and sells coffee. Maybe he should write the screenplay for this and get it in the hands of someone who would turn it into a film. The guy who opened fire inside the Holocaust Memorial Museum in D.C. More and more is coming out on this guy. Von Brunner. One of the notes that he left, and this cuts right to the core of the very brief blog that I put up at MikeMalloy.com today. I don't know if a mitigating factor is this man's age, 88. That may mean only that he's had an extra 30 or 40 years beyond people like him to nurture and feed his irrational sociopathology. But one of the notes found in his apartment, his car, I think it was in his car, in his briefcase, was the note said, "You want my weapons? This is how you get them." Now, I don't know his cognitive condition. His mental condition obviously was deranged. But people can be deranged and still make necessary decisions based on cognitive input. I mean, when they have to go to the bathroom, they know to go into the little room and take their pants down. When they're hungry, they know to open the refrigerator or the pantry and get something out and put it in their feeding hole. I don't know what this guy, you know, what his cognitive array or disarray was all about. But apparently people like Glenn Beck and Hannity and the rest of the swine got to him to the point where he was convinced someone was going to come and take his guns. And if that were the case, well, it had to be the Jews. Who else would come and get his guns? Obviously, the Jews want his guns. Or the Negro in the White House wants his guns. Or all the black folk out there who are going about the normal business of just being a person. They want his guns. And, of course, the commies want his guns. But, son of a bitch, he can't find any commies anymore. But the dark people and the Jews are very visible. Oh, and let's not forget the Muslims. They want his guns, too. And how about the liberals and the progressives? Man. Which leads me to Shepard Smith. Fox News Channel. You may have seen this already, but Shepard Smith, who probably isn't long for Fox News Channel. I've never watched his program to any degree. I've commented one time that he has gorgeous eyes. Shepard Smith probably has the most gorgeous eyes on a man that I think I've ever seen. And when I watched him one time or twice on television, I was just transfixed. I felt like a cobra, and he was a mongoose or something. I don't know. It was just bizarre because of his eyes. Okay, having said all that, now to get to Shepard Smith himself. He's a Fox News man, and I know we put quotes around the word news. He also has to share his employment perch with swine like Beck and Hannity and O'Reilly. Hannity, O'Reilly, and Beck probably are the most responsible for generating insanity and people like Brunner and death and murder and destruction in this country than any three people, with the possible exception of the pig man, Rush Limbaugh. But I think it's starting to get to Shepard Smith. He was expressing some outrage over the hundreds of emails they get at Fox, hateful emails directed at Obama and the Democrats. He was commenting on the psycho, gun-toting, neocon Fox viewers, his own viewers, who have become the most dangerous terrorist threat in America. Shepard Smith seems genuinely concerned here about these rabid killers, but he doesn't make the logical jump to the cause of their insane hatred and their homicidal tendencies. Fox News itself. Smith seems oblivious to that fact, but listen to what he has to say.
I read a lot of email around here, and the email to me has become more and more frightening. It's not a new thing. It's been happening over the past few months. It's been happening, you know, to some degree since the election process went along. I mean, we had a woman, we had a black man, we have, you know, we had a lot going on. And there are people now who are way out there on a limb, and I think they're just way out there on a limb with the email they send us, because I read it, and they are out there.
Yeah.
I mean, out there in a scary place. I'm going to read to you a little bit from one, and I'm not going to read the name, but this is, I promise, a representative sample of the kinds of things that we get here. Shepard, how dare you tell us to get over Obama not being a U.S. citizen? Where is the birth certificate? Where? He won't show it. So why are you so trumped up to believe it? I cannot stand Hussein. He is a socialist Marxist who is at fast rate destroying our country. If you're one who believes that abortion is murder, at what point do you go out and kill someone who's performing abortions? Well, I think we just learned for the killer of Dr. Tiller. If you are one who believes these sorts of things about the President of the United States, and I could read 100 of them like this.
Yeah, thousands.
No. I mean, from today, people who are so amped up and so angry for reasons that are absolutely wrong, ridiculous, preposterous. Yet they are mad, and they're very mad that I just called it preposterous.
Well, if anybody wants to know the level of anger or whatever you want to call it, crazy, just take a spin around the blogs out there on the internet, and just take half an hour and go out through and randomly see what is being said out there.
Yeah.
It's frightening on a lot of different levels, and part of the problem, I think, is that they're feeding each other.
They are.
People are not going out there.
They're on websites,
right,
feeding each other the same bunch of fact of hate that's not based in fact, and it's ginning itself up. And I guess if that's what you want to do with your time, maybe that's what you do. But more and more, it seems like people are taking the extra step and getting the gun out.
Now, that is Shepard Smith at Fox News Channel. And like I say, would you be surprised if within 3-4 days or maybe a respectable a length of time between that and his being fired? Because that's what Fox News Channel is about. That's what they hire people to do. That's why Glenn Beck was fired from Headline News and picked up at Fox. They hire people to absolutely turn this country into chaos.
He's a liberal with a microphone, and that makes him dangerous. It's Mike Malloy.
Well, only dangerous to freaks, geeks, and right-wing morons, right? We're going to play that Shepard Smith cut again next hour, I think. That was pretty shocking. Stephen from Burbank writes in, Mike, last night we were talking about how the innocent are prosecuted. That came from the conversation with former Alabama Governor Don Siegelman. And I made the point that prosecutorial misconduct results in thousands, if not tens of thousands, of people locked up every year. You know, there's a joke. Everybody in prison is innocent. I worked with somebody down here about 25 years ago on kind of a Georgia version of the Innocence Project. It had nothing to do with DNA. It had to do with, you know, this is before computers were available for private use or commercial use for that matter. Everything had to be done by hand, had to be done by research, go to the library, go through court records. And I worked with a guy who, oddly enough, his name was Dr. King. It was not no relation to the Martin Luther King family. And his he had a one-man office. He got letters from prisoners on death row, prisoners who were sentenced to life. And so many of these letters claimed innocence. And what Dr. King would do would be to spend his time examining every single one of them. He worked on grants from the Justice Department. He worked on grants from, this is back when Georgia was controlled by Democrats, so there was money for indigent defense, public defenders. All that money is gone now. Here in Georgia, as is true in most states, when somebody's convicted or somebody's arrested, that means they're guilty, period. Lock the sons of bitches up. They're trying to execute a man down here now who's been on death row for 14, 15 years. And there is tremendous concern about the fact that they'll be executing an innocent man, which we should spend some time talking about one of these nights on this program. But in working with Dr. King and coming to understand that there were, in fact, innocent people in prison was an eye opener for me. It really was. I guess it was about 25 or 30 years ago. I made the assumption that occasionally somebody might be innocent and inadvertently or deliberately convicted of a crime that they did not commit, but I had no idea it was to the extent that it does occur in this country. So, which brings me back to Stephen from Burbank's email. Mike, last night we were talking about how the innocent are prosecuted. I heard a right-wing caller to a show say that a 5% ratio of innocent people being executed was an acceptable margin. Of course it is, until it happens to him personally. Then what would he say? Just asking. There is a hardness of the heart of this country. This country really, truly, at this point in its history, and I think you'll understand what I'm saying right now, is soul dead. It is. This country is trying to operate without a soul. Now, a lot of people say, well, you're an atheist. Yeah. Okay. I'm not talking about God. I'm talking about a person's soul, for lack of a better term. You define any way you want to. I know how I define that. But the country itself, I don't know how this happened. I think capitalism did it. It absolutely eats away at everything it comes in contact with. Capitalism is the most corrosive form of enterprise, governance, economic system ever invented. It was done deliberately and maliciously. It was a replacement for feudalism, and God damn, it's worked well. Hasn't it? Hasn't it? For the people who designed it. It certainly has. So part of the soul death of this country has been, capitalism. Now, when I say the soul of this country's dead, maybe it's in a coma. Maybe it's on life support. Maybe there's a way to get it back. I don't know. But some of you out there listening to this, to what I'm saying right now will understand immediately what I'm talking about. Immediately. When I talk about this country is soul dead right now. It is. There is no question that it is. Whatever spiritual force exists inside this country right now is certainly on hold. And somebody's getting ready to hit the delete button. And you know that as well as I know that. And my hope is that before the delete key can be hit, there will be some sort of intervention, by individuals. I'm not talking about God. I'm not talking about sky spooks. You know what I'm talking about. You know exactly what I'm talking about. If you're tuned into what I'm saying, you know exactly what I'm talking about. If you're not tuned in, you can just attribute this to the gibbering of a liberal talk show host who doesn't know what the hell he's talking about, claims to be an atheist, which he is, claims to be a democratic socialist, which he is. So what the hell is he talking about? Souls and spirit? The spiritual nature of humans. Well, think about it for a while. We'll be right back. Not me. The links that I will go to. The distance in your eyes. Oh no, I said too much. I said it. It is 25 before the hour. Regarding that audio we played for you from Shepard Smith, Corey in Louisville, Kentucky writes, and Corey in Louisville, Kentucky has to listen to this program by catching the stream from KPTK in Seattle. He writes, Mike, I think Shep Smith realizes the root cause of the anger of fringe wing nuttia. His problem is that he doesn't have the stones to admit it while he's on the air. I can respect him for not saying so because he probably needs a job, and in this economy it's hard to get a new one. Smith is one person at Fox News that I do respect. He may have a conservative political view, but unlike any of the leaders of the conservative mouth-breathing fringe, he's not going to toe the party lines when something wrong happens. I caught his coverage of Katrina on YouTube. I saw him strongly and vehemently state that waterboarding is torture. And because of that absolute wrong, he dropped the F-bomb. Smith should not be long for Fox News. Unlike 99% of the on-air talent, he actually has journalistic and ethical standards. The sooner he goes to a respectable news organization like CNN or MSNBC, the better he can be used. Corey in Louisville, listening by way of KPTK in Seattle. P.S., that gun-toting crazy church is located in the southern part of the city. Oh, he's referring to the church. Remember, Kathy once going to have a picnic food, and you're supposed to bring your gun. You're supposed to holster your gun and bring it in, but don't pack bullets.
But bring canned goods.
Bring a canned good. Corey writes, that gun-toting crazy church is located in the southern part of the city, very white, very poor, very Republican. And also, Michael Wiener, Savage, is pulling his show from the big 50,000-watt channel to go to another FM-based station. I would love to stop listening to you over the Internet and actually turn on my radio and hear you live, although I can always get you from the podcast. I mean, they're only 25 cents a day. That's true. Yeah, so you can listen either way. Corey can, streaming from KPTK or via the Internet, via the podcasts. But that just, I love KPTK. I'm going to be in Seattle at some point soon for an event. But to have to listen to, you know, he's in Louisville. To have to listen to a station, 1,800 miles from Louisville to hear progressive talk is, well, whatever, never mind. This is from Marla. Listening on Sirius in Peterborough, Ontario, Canada. Mike, I saw a new book in my bookstore today, June 10th. I guess it'd be yesterday, right? Called Censorship, The Threat to Silence Talk Radio by Brian Jennings. And the foreword was written by Sean Hannity. The inside dust jacket description reads, quote, if key Democrats have their way, end quote, the FCC's fairness doctrine will be once again enforced and will allow the Obama government to control the content heard on radio. The book is crying for support for all the poor little right-wing talkers who might be silenced. They feel threatened by the new government. Oh, to shut them up would be bliss. But we know they're scheming all over the place to circumvent that. Marla. Yeah, that, you know, you talk about a straw man creating something that is and is creating something that's non-existent. In the first place, I've said this before, and most of these right-wing trolls, if they don't understand this, I think they do understand it, but it's something to stir up their idiotic audiences. The Fairness Doctrine primarily was invented for passed, legislation was passed for television. At a time when there were three, most markets had three networks on the VHF. Which one is it? Which one is over the air? You know, like channel, like ABC, NBC, CBS. Is that VHF? Yeah, and UHF would be like your educational channels back in the day. That's the way it was, kiddies. So when there were three VHF channels in most markets, ABC, CBS, and NBC, and usually the station managers at some point during the day, usually at the noon news or at the 6 o'clock local news, they would come on and give their little 2 or 3 or 4 minute political point of view. And the Fairness Doctrine said if the station general manager is going to come on the air and say, we do not support gun control, let's pick that one. Then the Fairness Doctrine said you also had to bring on somebody within a reasonable period of time after that to say, yes, gun control is good. You see what I'm saying? Because the stations operated using the public airwaves. Public, remember, they used to be public. Now they're corporate owned. Because the stations were operating in the public airwaves and had a license granted by the federal government, this is what the right-wing pissants won't tell you. Every license, every broadcast license in the country for radio and television is something granted, given to them. It's a license for these TV stations. It's a license to print money, or TV networks. It's a license to print money. no matter how many screwy people like Hannity or Beck or O'Reilly they put out there, again, if 15% of the population of this country is insane where it concerns politics, well, that's 45 million, or what is it? 45 million people who will tune in. Any network or radio, television station or program that can draw 45 million people, is a pretty good. I think CBS Nightly or NBC or ABC Nightly News only draws about 8 or 9 million. So you see the potential market is huge because we are a nation of crazy people, or at least, and if you work in mental health, I'm sorry, I don't mean to be a jackass here with these kinds of statements. I'm not talking, I'm using it as allegorical or, you know what I mean. So anyway, Jesus, I've completely lost my train of thought. The Fairness Doctrine was a straw man. For Hannity or anybody to say that the Democrats are going to reinstitute the Fairness Doctrine, which will then give them the power, the Democrats the power to stop over-the-air broadcasting. Do you get the craziness just in that sentence? And do you also get... And I just wonder, the right-wingers who lap this stuff up like a dog eating cat vomit, the ones that listen to Hannity and the rest of these thugs, when they hear Hannity and Beck and the rest of them saying, well, they want to bring back the Fairness Doctrine, do the listeners not understand what they're saying? We don't want fairness? I mean, does that totally escape these crazy right-wing people in this country? That what's being said by the right-wingers is we don't want the Fairness Doctrine because in a real marketplace of ideas, the right-wingers would be swamped. The only about, I mean, 15, 16, 18, 19% of America pays any attention to this garbage. But, oh, man. I mean, on an active basis. So why you talk about it, Malloy, if it's only 18-19%? Because they have such premier spots on the broadcast dial. You know, any city, I don't care what city it is. I don't care. Take a Tom Hartman and put him on from noon to three against Rush Limbaugh. And make it a six-month contest. And I will guarantee you, with the possible exception of Birmingham, Alabama, or Oklahoma City, I don't know, Atlanta, if it's a rational, well, maybe even in those cities, because usually in the cities themselves, there are still people who have a part of a brain left. But you put Hartman up against Limbaugh, and Hartman will swamp him. I guarantee you that would be the, I would stake my job on it. You give him 6 months and Hartman will kick his ass. And let's not leave Malloy out. You put me up against any of these right-wing pissants, any of them. I remember when I was on in New York and won the AIR Award, Achievement of Radio Award, best radio talk show in New York City. Who did I defeat? Al Franken, Randy Rhodes, Rush Limbaugh, this freak named Malzberg, and Sean Hannity. I mean, this happens in any market where you have a liberal, progressive, in other words, a rational human being in a talk format on one station, and on another station, the same market, same time, you have one of these right-wing psychopaths like Limbaugh or Hannity. Every single time, the liberal or the progressive will kick the conservative or the right-winger's ass up around his shoulders. Invariably, it happens. So, which begs the question, well, then why isn't it done that way? Because corporate America does not want dialogue. It wants monologue.
from another world. In one, the surface was nosy. In another, I witnessed the crime. In one, I was running, and in another, all I see.
Embrace your inner liberal warrior with Mike Malloy.
It's about nine before the hour. We have a contest that is coming up. We're going to run it every Friday night for 5 weeks. Is that right, Kathy? Ladies and gentlemen, and the producer of this program, Catherine Bay, to explain what the contest is.
We had a very generous listener donate, and he wants to remain anonymous, 10 podcast subscriptions.
Wow.
Podcast subscriptions. Hey, that's a lot of quarters.
That's a chunk of money.
You buy a lot of candy bars then.
Boy. Money.
So we're so grateful to him, and we decided to give away 2 a week starting tomorrow night. Every Friday, we're going to give away 2 a week.
Free podcast subscriptions. Which also gets you into Malloy's Uncensored Mailbag and whatever else we can...
Malloy Online Community. Oh, and by the way, just an aside, we have new merchandise, not just t-shirts and bumpers. We have coffee mugs. There's more to come.
More to come.
Anyway, but the way we're going to do this is we're going to ask people tomorrow night to call in if they would like a free podcast subscription. And the only catch is you have to answer a trivia question correctly.
And we don't ask the question until we have you on the line, so
right.
you can't Google it. You can't Wikipedia it.
Unless you're really quick with your
BlackBerry. And each person that we get until the 2 free subscriptions are given away, we'll keep taking phone calls, but the question will change with each person.
Exactly.
So you can't be on hold and hear and say, oh, you got it wrong. Hey, click on me. I got it right. No. Each person will get a different question. So we again, like Kathy said, we're deeply appreciative of the person who did this, who purchased 10 of these podcast subscriptions.
You want a sample question?
Yeah, go ahead.
Just for example. I'm trying to put this thing together.
Okay.
Who said this? Let's see if you can get this right.
Okay.
Who said, death has a tendency to encourage a depressing view of war? Was it Dick Cheney, Don Rumsfeld, Barbara Bush, or Condi Rice?
I'd say Rumsfeld.
Bing, 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 bing.
Is that right?
You get a free podcast.
Oh, there you go. Okay. So they're going to be multiple choice, and it's going to be mostly quotes?
Yeah, I think tomorrow night, just for the heck of it, because I miss him so much, we're going to do Bush. I think it's going to be like all true or false, did he say it or not, which that's always fun because you never know.
So this would be a true or false, not a multiple.
Some multiple choice,
okay.
For example, here's one, complete the quote.
Okay.
Too many good docs are getting out of business. Too many OBGYNs aren't able to practice their blank with women all across this country. Is it religion, pickup lines, love, or witchcraft?
Love!
Very good. Ding, 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 ding,
I win
ding,
two
ding.
Of them.
2 podcast subscriptions.
Hot damn.
That's worth about 3 Swanson TV dinners right there.
There you go. All right. Well, this sounds like this is going to be fun. So if you have been thinking about you'd like to have a podcast subscription, and just haven't gotten around to purchasing one, here's a way you can get one free. By participating in our little contest, we'll give away 2 a week for the next 5 weeks. And again, the person who made the purchase of these 10 subscriptions wants to remain anonymous, which is okay with us. But thank you very much. We do appreciate it. All right, where are we? We're just about ready for a break. We have little breaking news. I think it's breaking news. I haven't seen it until it was just sent to me. The U.S. government can keep pictures of detainee abuse secret while it asks the Supreme Court to permanently block release of the photographs on the grounds they could incite violence in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Pakistan. That's what a federal appeals court has said late today. They could incite violence in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Pakistan. What the hell is going on there now? Oh, well. The one-paragraph ruling by the Second U.S. Circuit in Manhattan came after the Obama administration asked the court to keep the pictures secret so it could appeal to the nation's highest court. So this is an injunction, I guess, because another court has issued a ruling in favor of the ACLU that sued to get these released, and that court said release them. The Obama administration appealed that. Now, I don't know if this went to an appeals court, but I don't know if this is... I guess it's just a stay or what do you call it, injunction? We've got so many lawyers that listen to this. Maybe somebody will tell me the proper term. Anyway, the administration last month said the disturbing photographs pose, quote, a clear and grave risk of inciting violence and riots against American and coalition forces, as well as civilian personnel serving in Iraq and Afghanistan, end quote. The appeals court stayed its order supporting a lower court judge's decision to order release of the photographs until the Supreme Court has a chance to consider the case. That's probably going to be a while. Isn't the court ready? The Supreme Court's ready. They're issuing their rulings now, and then they adjourn until the first Monday in October. So it may be some time. To support its arguments, the Obama administration filed partially secret statements from two top U.S. generals, David Petraeus and Ray Odierno. In the filings, Odierno, who commands the troops in Iraq, said the 2004 release of photos of detainee abuse at Abu Ghraib, quote, likely contributed to a spike in violence in Iraq, end quote, that year. And there's more here, which we will probably share with you when we come back. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
Provider and licensing.
It's 7 past the hour, so late today, this is the Malloy program, late today the second U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in Manhattan ruled in favor of the Obama administration's request to stop the release of more of these pictures of detainee abuse and torture and whatever videos might be remaining after the CIA destroyed, I think, 90 of them. The ACLU had filed for the release of these, had filed a court record, what do you call it, filed a suit to get these photos released. I would assume that, you know, the ACLU is not a voyeuristic organization that's into torture porn. What the ACLU was attempting to do, I believe, according to their own statement, was get the pictures released so the American public can see the extent to which the Bush crime family took this country into an area that we just shouldn't be. We just shouldn't be. And how we lost our whatever moral or ethical bearings that we had left, and they were frayed, absolutely, certainly coming apart at the seams. But the Bush crime family took it all the way and severed whatever whatever connection we still had to some sort of moral imperative or ethical conduct. The Bush crime family certainly ended it. What happens now? Well, the people who committed these criminal acts should be brought to justice. How do you bring them to justice when political power, party in power does not have the courage to stand up for the oath of office that they took to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States, when obviously these people violated every single law that is available to be violated in what they did? So understanding that and realizing that nothing is going to happen on an official level. There is not going to be a Justice Department probe. There is not going to be hearings in before any congressional committee. There is not going to be a special prosecutor. There is not going to be a commission of inquiry that is not connected to the Congress. Nothing. Do you understand that? Nothing is going to happen. Nothing. So the ACLU, hoping that the shock of these photos might inspire the people to demand other elected representatives, which is the only way that this could possibly happen. And even then, it's kind of iffy. You know, a big day in terms of emails delivered to any member of Congress, an enormous day would be 2,000 emails. Really push it. 5,000. Okay, really push it. 20,000. What is 20,000 as a percentage of 300 million? Nothing. So, the attempt was made. The court ruled that the ACLU did have standing to make that request through the court and said, yes, release him under Freedom of Information Act or whatever act of Congress was applied. The court said, okay, sure, the law is the law. At that point, the Obama administration had said, yeah, we support the release of all of this garbage. Get it all out. But then all of a sudden, that came to an abrupt, screeching, screaming halt. And you can draw your own conclusions as to how it stopped. The official story is that David Petraeus and Ray Odierno, respectively the head of CENTCOM and the commander in Iraq, said that these photos would incite violence in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Pakistan. Yeah, I'm pausing so you can snigger and go, what? Okay, so. In the filings, Odierno, who commands the troops in Iraq, and I'm going back now to the AP release on this, said that the 2004 release of photos of detainee abuse at Abu Ghraib likely contributed to a spike in violence in Iraq that year. Petraeus, who oversees U.S. military operations in the Middle East and Central Asia, said the images could also lead to more violence in Pakistan because it deals with Taliban attacks. I'm not sure what that means, but anyway. The ACLU had sought the release of 21 pictures. That's all. Not 9,000. 21 pictures. And in their suit, they said the action would make the government more accountable and help bring an end to the abuse of prisoners. ACLU lawyer Amrit Singh said, quote, "We are disappointed by this ruling. It further delays the disclosure of photographs that are critical to informing the debate about the treatment of U.S. prisoners." End quote. By the treatment of U.S. prisoners, he means treatment of prisoners in U.S. control, obviously. A spokesman for the government lawyers in Manhattan at the when this ruling was handed down today said the government had no comment. So, oh, and by the way, just as a postscript to all this, the photographs in color were taken by members of the U.S. military in Iraq and Afghanistan. U.S. law allows restrictions when images could reasonably be expected to endanger someone's life or safety. So the a U.S. district judge in Manhattan back in 2006 had ordered the release of the pictures once identifying facial features were removed. So it has all come to a stop now. The appeals court noted in its September ruling, the ruling back in September said, yeah, release these 21 photos. And the appeals court noted then that the U.S. government supported and even championed the release of photographs after World War II that depicted emaciated prisoners, corpses of prisoners, and powerless and subjugated detainees. The U.S. government at the time believed wide dissemination of the pictures could help hold perpetrators accountable. That was then. This is now. So, you know, my kind of facile argument that we've lost our moral underpinnings or whatever shreds of that we had left, I think hold up. My argument holds up. It wasn't that long ago. It was in my lifetime that the U.S. government said release all these photos to show the atrocities that were committed against civilians. Release them so that governments would be held accountable. That's what we said. Of course, we prosecuted people at Nuremberg, too. And we prosecuted people in Tokyo, too. We said there are certain things that in the horror of war, even these things will not be allowed to occur. If they do occur, the people committing these acts will be held accountable. That was then. This is now. This is how far we've slipped our moorings. This is where we are. We are adrift. And the ACLU, one could argue, was attempting to, I hate to use these maritime analogies, but was metaphors, was attempting to throw the ship of state a rope. How's that? To bring us back into port, tie us up at the pier, secure the ship of state. How's that? And of course, the court has ruled no. Now, it's obviously a temporary order because this will go to the U.S. Supreme Court, and but it won't be till next fall, probably. That's when the case will go to the court, and the court will probably rule after doing its due deliberations and arguments and presentations and yada yada. So at the very earliest, we are looking at a year from now before the U.S. Supreme Court will rule on this ACLU suit. I mean, that's how I see it. Maybe it's not going to work out that way at all. But so no accountability. Donald Rumsfeld, George Bush, Dick Cheney, John Yoo, Judge Bybee, all of these people, Addington, I just go down the list. You know, I'm not going to bore you with a list of perpetrators, but they're all off the hook. They're completely off the hook. Whatever happened really never happened. It just didn't. So move on. There's nothing to see here, folks. Move on.
There's a shadow on the faces of the men who fanned the flames of the wars that are fought in places where we can't even say the names. They sell us the president the same way. They sell us our clothes and our cars. They sell us everything from youth to religion. The same time they sell us our wars. I want to know who the men in the shadows are. I want to hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are. But they're never the ones to fight.
Cleaning up America one flying monkey at a time. It's More Mike Malloy.
Twenty-one past the hour. Our missive from Prairie 2 this evening. Our economics correspondent, and the subject line is sailing on the SS Latvia.
Uh-oh.
Prairie 2 writes, Latvia is the next domino expected to fall in the global meltdown. Not a big deal compared to other world events, but as our ship slides along the iceberg, it is yet another rivet popping from the hull plating. And there aren't enough lifeboats. Oil prices are climbing again as the dollar sinks. U.S. consumer spending is up, but mostly on higher gas prices. The number of jobs lost per month is down, but still at a high number. The number of continuing unemployment claims is down, but the number of people unemployed is up. This means people who were getting unemployment on the extension Bush signed last fall are running out of benefits. This will be another drag on the economy, and job losses will pick up speed again. News reports are that the right-wing terrorist that attacked the Holocaust Museum was living hand-to-mouth. As more of the formerly middle class realize that the American dream is gone for good, the messengers of hate from the right will find more and more willing listeners who will step over the line. Remember, Hitler recruited the brown shirt thugs from the soup kitchens. Obama has to start talking about bringing back the middle class jobs and stop worrying about China's desire to keep those jobs over there. Of course, the real problem isn't China, but rather the Republicans who also want to keep the middle class jobs over there. China could cut us off any day. Fear of panic at home is the only thing that stops them. If things start to get out of hand, branding us as the enemy might suit their needs better. Imagine the stores without all of the things that are made in China or are dependent on parts from China. Latvia will probably be much better off. Pray too. Go to his website, prairie2.com, and let him know if you agree or disagree. Engage him. In Danville, Virginia, a family there says the police officer shot their family pet. While the cop was answering a call at their neighbor's house, the dog's name was Killer, but the family says he was gentle as can be. Killer was a miniature dachshund, weighed about 12 pounds. Stood a few inches off the ground. I'm not laughing because the dog was shot. The family says it doesn't make sense. The dad said he'd never bitten anyone. He would bark. He did his fair share of barking. He had a big bark for a little dog. But on Monday night, the family says the barking stopped because the police officer making a stop next door shot and killed their pet. The owner of the dog said, quote, he said, I had to shoot your dog. He was barking at me and that was that. The family says they don't understand why police needed to shoot such a little dog. Well, the owner said a good kick in the butt, you know what I'm saying, could have avoided this. I could understand if he was a pit bull, a Doberman, a bigger dog, but he was a little dachshund. I think the officer went to the extreme. The family says this is a close, quiet neighborhood. Not one where guns are fired. The dog's owner said, I don't feel safe about that. There could have been kids around. And now they say their home has been shaken. The family has had this little dog for 11 years, and losing him is killing them. One little boy said he was like a brother to me, some kind of brother. Little girl said he was like a member of the family. He had his part on the Christmas tree and his presence under the Christmas tree. It's like a member of the family. The reporter who filed this said he spoke with representatives from the Danville, Virginia Police Department. All they would tell him is that they are reviewing the case and will issue a statement at a later date. Now, the person that sent this to me said, you've got to do this on the air tonight. Okay. There you are. I hope no little kids were listening. That's awful. That's, you know, he was barking at me, so I had to shoot him. Really? He was barking at you and you had to shoot him. Okay. Two articles here about the military. U.S. military deaths in the Iraq War now stand at 4,314. That's just Iraq. Um, 31,342 U.S. service members have been wounded. Man, And the number of potential or confirmed suicides since January of U.S. military personnel stands at 82. So the rate among soldiers, the suicide rate among soldiers continues on a record pace. We'll be back after the break. I'm Mike Malloy.
Dead puppies aren't much fun. They don't come when you call. They don't chase squirrels at all. Dead puppies aren't much fun.
Because without dissent, it's not America. Here's Mike Malloy.
It's about 25 before the hour. All right, I made an executive decision here, and I'm going to share with you what Jonathan Schell has in the June 15th issue this year of The Nation. It's lengthy. It's not all that long, but if you at any point get bored with it and want to drop out, I understand. It's entitled Torture and Truth, Americans' Insistence on Turning Away from the Past is Preventing Us from Building a Future. Jonathan Schell writes, it has fallen to President Obama to deal with the policies and practices of torture inaugurated by the Bush administration. He started boldly, ordering an end to the abuses, announcing the closing in 1 year of the detention camp at Guantanamo and releasing the Bush-era Justice Department memos authorizing torture. Subsequently, he seemed to grow cautious. He discouraged formation of an independent commission to investigate the torture and reversed a previous position in favor of releasing Pentagon photos of abuses and instead opposed release. In his May 21st speech at the National Archives, he seemed to try to create a framework for understanding his policies, but they remained very much a work in progress. He surprisingly embraced a number of Bush policies, including military commissions for trying detainees, the use of the state secrets privilege to protect information in court, and the indefinite use of preventive detention, all to be revised in ways that were left vague or unspecified. Yet among these reversals and improvisations, one very general preference has remained steady. Throughout, Obama has expressed a desire to concentrate on the future rather than the past. As he put it a while back, he is bent on, quote, getting things right in the future as opposed to looking at what we got wrong in the past, end quote. Or as he said in the National Archives speech, quote, we need to focus on the future while resisting those with the strong desire to focus on the past, end quote. But can the United States really get things right in the future by turning away from the past? For one thing, the factual record is still incomplete. For another, the reasons for what went wrong aren't as clear as they might at first seem. Why did the United States make the decision to torture? What changes does it portend for American life? It seems likely that getting things right will depend on having answers to these questions. When the full history of the Bush administration is finally told, one event may prove iconic. The torture of the al-Qaeda operative Ibn al-Shaykh al-Libi, who recently died, allegedly by his own hand, in a prison in Libya, where he was sent by the United States. Libby was captured in Pakistan in late 2001. At first, he was interrogated by the FBI, and he provided useful information on the inner workings of al-Qaeda. But more was wanted from him. The Bush administration, hell-bent on justifying its forthcoming invasion of Iraq, was ransacking the intelligence bureaucracy to find or produce two things that, it turns out, did not exist. Weapons of mass destruction programs in Iraq and cooperation between al-Qaeda and the regime of Saddam Hussein. Pressure to find evidence of both intensified in 2002. At the same time, the practice of torture, authorized by the White House, the Justice Department, and the Pentagon, was spreading throughout the intelligence and military establishments. Soon, prisoners were being tortured to provide evidence of the Al-Qaeda-Saddam link. As Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, former Secretary of State Colin Powell's chief of staff, has stated, quote, the harsh interrogation in April and May of 2002 was not aimed at preempting another terrorist attack on the U.S., but discovering a smoking gun linking Iraq and Al-Qaeda, end quote. And according to the recent Senate Armed Services Committee report on the treatment of detainees, a former Army psychiatrist, Major Charles Burney, has confirmed the charge. He told Army investigators, quote, a large part of the time, we were focused on trying to establish a link between Al-Qaeda and Iraq, and we were not successful. The more frustrated people got in not being able to establish that link, there was more and more pressure to resort to measures that might produce more immediate results, end quote. The CIA took custody of Libby and began to expose him to abuse. Next, it rendered him to Egypt, where he was subjected to, among other torments, severe beatings and confinement in a tiny cage for more than 80 hours. He then produced the desired false statements linking Al-Qaeda with the Iraqi government. Just as minute specifications for torture were flowing down through the ranks of bureaucrats from the Justice Department, the Pentagon, and the White House, where an array of abuses was once demonstrated to high officials, reportedly including cabinet members, so the results of the torture were flowing upward. By this route, Libby and his testimony were destined for a history-making role. The centerpiece of Powell's speech before the UN Security Council justifying the invasion of Iraq devoted a full 9 paragraphs to a, quote, senior terrorist operative, end quote, who, quote, fortunately is now detained, end quote. Libby, though unnamed, was the star of the performance. Powell unwound a long tale of terrorist and weapons of mass destruction, all subsequently disavowed by Libby as well as otherwise discredited. Al-Qaeda, Powell said, had been pursuing weapons of mass destruction in Afghanistan, but finding the resources inadequate, had needed, quote, to look outside of Afghanistan for help, end quote. So, quote, they went to Iraq, end quote, where they received, quote, chemical or biological weapons training, end quote. Thus did Powell weave together the two main fabrications about Iraq, that it was pursuing weapons of mass destruction and it was cooperating with Al-Qaeda. In Iraq's avowals to the contrary, Powell said, quote, it's all a web of lies, end quote. The moment is worth dwelling in. In the most dramatic and widely watched presentation of the case for war, the Secretary of State, a man of high reputation at home and abroad, was conveying perjured testimony exacted by torture to the entire world in its appointed agora, the UN Security Council. Without knowing it, the assembled representatives had been dragged into complicity with a hidden system of torture. The war, as we learn later from the photos of Abu Ghraib, produced torture. But before that happened, torture had produced the war. The event shows in microcosm the relationship of torture and truth. Supposedly, the aim of torture is to produce information, but its likelier outcome is to produce misinformation, which may be what is desired. A recent Washington Post cartoon by Tom Tolles summed up the point. A torturer stands over his victim, who is on his back on a waterboard. The torturer says, there's a problem of getting false information. Dick Cheney, standing next to him, responds, problem? This purpose of the Bush-era torture is inscribed in its origins. In the Korean War, the Chinese invented torture techniques whose aim was to force American prisoners of war to make false confessions of participation in war crimes for use in propaganda. Since false confessions, not information, were the desired product, a heavy emphasis was placed on sensory deprivation and other techniques for producing mental breakdown. Later, in the so-called Survival, Evasion, Resistance, and Escape Program, the SEER program, the U.S. military tried to train soldiers to resist confessing by subjecting them to milder variations of the techniques. It was these that the Bush administration turned back to their original use, which, of course, had been, and again was, not obtaining information, but producing propaganda. In a passage that uncannily anticipated the Powell speech, Elaine Scarry wrote in her classic work, The Body in Pain, that torture, quote, permits one person's body to be translated into another person's voice and allows real human pain to be converted into a regime's fiction of power, end quote. The victim's world is shattered by torture. More than any other experience, extreme pain shuts a person up in a world of incommunicable agony. Jacobo Timmerman, who underwent torture at the hands of the Argentine generals in the late 70s, has written that even as he was tortured, he tried to think how to communicate the experience to others in words, but was unable. The torturer, inversely, asserts and expands his world, his word, at the expense of the shattered world of the victim, as Paul did at the UN. For, as Elaine Scarry writes, quote, the torturer and the regime have doubled their voice since the prisoner is now speaking their words, end quote. But why is the gain only the fiction of power? Well, it might seem that more than any other activity, torture is an exercise in absolute power. The torturer can do anything he dreams up to the perfectly helpless prisoner. He can take his time deciding what torments to impose. He can slam the prisoner's head against a wall, waterboard him, order him to pray to a god not his own, smear his face with feces, lock him up in a box, keep him awake for a week, hang him from the wall, and beat him to death. All things that have been done in American detention centers since 9/11. But what is the power, and how far does it extend beyond the torturer's chambers? Scarry observes that the state, in denying the victim's pain, converts the vision of suffering into the wholly illusory, but to the torturers and the regime they represent, wholly convincing spectacle of power. And it is, quote, precisely because the reality of that power is so highly contestable, the regime is unstable, so unstable that torture is being used, end quote. Libby's behavior is a case in point. He produced material to buttress an illusion. The illusion was deployed to open the way to a war. The war had a high cost precisely in the currency of the power of the United States. Power to produce fantasy is not power in the real world. And the Iraq War has been a disaster in that real world. There's more of this when we come back.
Gather around the campfire. It's more Mike Malloy.
10 before the hour. Continuing with what Jonathan Schell wrote, Torturing the Truth, at the Nation magazine, June 15th edition. It is no accident, then, that the United States approved torture at the highest levels of government exactly at the moment it began the most precipitous decline in global power in its history. Torture is one more sign of this weakness, which it feeds. It is a mere pantomime of the power notably missing elsewhere. In the torture chamber, the sole superpower still feels super, almost omnipotent. It is not so in the villages of Afghanistan, Iraq, and Pakistan's Swat Valley, or in Pyongyang or Tehran. The cult of force can create an illusion of power in the black site prisons. Even the illusion is missing outside them. The wound goes deeper. Even as the torturer shatters the world of his victim, he assaults the foundation of his own world, although he does not know it. Indeed, his blindness is a consequence of the torture, even a condition for it. The torturer and his victim are close to each other. There is physical contact. Yet, in every other respect, they are as distant as it is possible for one person to be from another. In the moral and affective vacuum that has been generated, sympathy, empathy, pity, understanding, every form of fellow feeling have been reduced to absolute zero. That is why torture is always, in Scarry's words, quote, an undoing of civilization, end quote. And probably more reliably than anything, it foreshadows the descent of a civilization into barbarism. The power of the state that tortures may be increasingly fictional, but the degradation of its civilization is real. Those symptoms are brought on, of course, not just by the torture, but by the society's reaction to it. The interrogator faces his choice when the order to torture comes down from on high. The people face their choice when reports of what he did are made public, as is happening now. If the people choose denial, the pathology of torture tends to reproduce itself in the society at large. The result is a kind of cognitive dislocation, which can be more or less severe. Fundamental human capacities begin to atrophy or are impaired. Certainly, abuse of human beings and abuse of words go hand in hand. The words that name the deed fog over or are driven from the language. Refusal to face the fact of torture has cost us the very word torture, now widely referred to, as if in obedience to some general edict, as enhanced interrogation techniques or harsh method. Torture's writ thus runs in the editorial rooms of newspapers. Other words drift free from their appropriate contexts and float into inappropriate ones. For example, in a statement responding to the recent release of memos from the Office of Legal Counsel authorizing forms of torture, Dennis Blair, the Director of National Intelligence, objected to the word pain that had been caused. But he did not mean that one would have thought, he did not mean what one would have thought, the pain of the victim. He meant the torturer's pain upon finding themselves censured for their abuse. Recalling the discomfort of operatives who had been called to account after the Vietnam War, he said that he could, quote, remember well the pain of those who served our country, even when the policies we were carrying out were unpopular or could be second-guessed, end quote. Now he complained, quote, we in the intelligence community should not be subjected to similar pain, end quote. In this response, the screams of the tortured had been shut out, and only the whining of the torturers could be heard. Or consider the frequently made charge that indictment of those who performed or ordered torture would amount to criminalizing policy decisions. In this accusation, those who really criminalize policy, that is, those who ordered crimes as a matter of policy, are given immunity by charging those who would prosecute the crimes with criminalizing. Torture, after all, was made criminal not by those who would apply the law, but by those who drafted and passed the law, including Title 18 of the U.S. Criminal Code. The application of that law no more criminalizes any deed than a prosecutor criminalizes bank robbery when he indicts a bank robber. At an even deeper level, the bonds that connect the very tenses of human life, past, present, and future, may start to come unglued. It is in this context that our new president's determination to get things right in the future by ignoring what went wrong in the past is troubling. Here, the past, per se, is at risk of being demeaned by a sort of guilt by association with torture. The other two tenses, though seemingly preferred, do not escape unharmed. The danger is most obvious in the legal system, where it is precisely the past, the precedent of law, plus the factual record of the case, that determines the future to be taken. Someone brought into court for dealing drugs is not invited to say to the judge, "Let's not look at the past, let's concentrate on getting the future right." But more than the legal system is at stake, for whatever else civilization may be, it is surely intercourse between past, present, and future. Without the past to guide it, judgment about the future is reduced to clueless conjecture. And without informed judgment about the future, we wander lost in the present. Better to look the torture in the face. And having looked, to remember. And having remembered, to respond. And having responded, to call those responsible to account, so that we never do this again. Jonathan Schell, writing at The Nation in the June 15th edition. That essay just put into context for me the absolute necessity, if this country is to survive, in any frame resembling what the originators of this country had in mind, not what they did, but what they had in mind, if we are to survive on any level in that direction, then we have got to confront what happened in this country during the regime of George W. Bush. Occasionally get emails from people that say, you know, why do you keep talking about this? Why do you keep... to me, this is the most, one of the most profound questions that we have facing us in this country. I don't care how old we are. These are questions that anybody who can understand the issue of torture, that would be, I guess, teenagers to people in their 90s. As long as this is unresolved, just like Jonathan Schell says, we are corrupting, we truly are corrupting our future if we don't deal with this. This is not some voyeuristic trip. This is not, oh, let's put the Bush crime family on trial because he was such a jerk to begin with. No. These are crimes against humanity. These are actions that dehumanize not just the individuals who commit the torture, but the entire society. And I don't think I or any of us are aware of the depth of that corruption if we let this go by. A footnote to all of this is the U.S. reputation around the globe. That's an afterthought. The main issue here, and I believe this, is what this has done to us. I wonder sometimes, how do we Americans in our normal day-to-day activities, those of us who are aware of something larger than ourselves, you know, our country, our position on Earth, the environment, you know, issues bigger than just, you know, what am I going to have for lunch today? Who am I going to screw to make an extra $100,000 this year? You know, the larger issues. How do people who think about the larger issues, how do we process the fact or carry in our heads the fact that we have committed, we as a nation have committed these crimes? And I think most people say, well, it wasn't me. I didn't do it. God damn, I'm not responsible for this. I'm not even a Republican. That doesn't wash. That's what Jonathan Schell is trying to say. Once we know what happened, and we do know what happened, once we know that and do nothing, then we just more or less sink into the same corruption that was eating alive the torturer. And that's the part I think that really worries me. A lot of us that do this program, listen to this program, or on this side of the mic, that side of the mic, whatever, we're of a certain age. We're not going to be around that much longer. But what about, honest to God, what about the people in their teens, 20s, 30s, 40s who are, what about the kids that, you know, are 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 years old? Well, I mean, what is it that we're going to leave them? We're going to leave them a legacy of war and death and destruction. That's one thing. I mean, how many generations in the history of humanity have not done that? But we are leaving them a legacy of torture? Okay, fine. God damn it. Let's just do that then. But then let's change our mythology. Let's change our story. We are the United States of America. We torture. We elect leaders who will dehumanize other human beings in order to get a certain answer. How big of a step is it from that to the death camps? Seriously. How big of a step is it? Is it a big step? Is it a small step? And in the meantime, the shredding of the social fabric, whatever trust might have existed, even though challenged, frayed, even though kind of weak, the trust that we have. Well, I can walk out of my house and not worry about being gunned down by brown shirts. Well, I can go to the mall and not worry that I'm going to see a bunch of skinheads or neo-Nazis beating up old people because they're Jews or Muslims or gay. That's kind of the agreement that we have in this country. How long before that disappears? An isolated incident of a physician being gunned down, or somebody walking into a Holocaust museum and opening fire, as horrible as those events are, they're isolated incidents, aren't they, or are they? So what happens when we have brown shirts? What happens when the incidents are not isolated? How come we tend to ignore historical examples of what happens when this begins? You know, the classic example for Westerners is the pogroms and then the murder, systematic murder of the Jews. There are other examples of this. We can look at other societies where people just let it go. Just let it go. And hundreds of thousands were butchered, murdered, slaughtered. This really gets it gets me apparently right at the foundation of where I live, and you know, in my heart, my soul, my mind, my spirit, whatever. And it probably does you too. So what do we do? What do we do? The official government position right now is to silence this. No investigation, no inquiry, no hearings, no photographs, no videos. Silence it. Now, yes, the Obama administration says, well, let's see what the Supreme Court says. Is that the Obama administration giving itself cover as a matter of self-preservation? Maybe. We understand, don't we, you and I? We understand. You see, white folks understand. Black folks understand. And that's as far as I'm going to divide us. White folks understand the potential within our ranks to kill people. Black folks understand the potential within our ranks to kill people. You understand what I'm saying with that? So, Barack Obama is a combination, isn't he? Of black folk and white folk, isn't he? Of course he is. So maybe it's self-preservation for his family and for him. That he is saying, look, let's let the Supreme Court decide. If that's the case, that's certainly understandable and it's forgivable, if forgiveness is what's asked for here. But as far as I'm concerned, and maybe you, this can't be buried, be covered up. We invaded two countries. The second invasion, as Jonathan Schell says, the torture, the war created the torture, but before that, the torture created the war. Jesus, God, do you hear what he is saying with that? So, what to do about it, right? Justine writes, Mike, I still recall the evening you read a listener a listener's letter about torture under what I think, if I recall correctly, was the Chilean regime in the 70s. It might have been Argentina, in which individuals picked up off the streets were placed in a box and then confined with just their heads exposed. Their bodies began to decompose by their own feces and urine, and when they were eaten alive by the maggots that swarmed to the rotting flesh, I believe the writer said these individuals were left in the open in town squares, for example, as a means of terrorizing the community and citizenry at large. To think that this is the kind of hell that Cheney, Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, you, Rice, and the rest of the Bush crime syndicate put human beings through on our behalf. What kind of demented mind even conjures up such torture? One of the questions now is, how can we begin to crawl back from the horror and terror we've inflicted while choosing to remain under a shroud of secrecy, Justine? Yeah, my point exactly. And I think anyone who wants to make a personal claim of morality, I don't care if it's religion-based or philosophically based or humanistically based, anyone who wants to make a claim of morality or that they have or their group has or their belief system has moral underpinnings has got to demand that this be confronted. Has got to. Do you agree? See, I'm getting a bunch of emails here, people wanting a link to the Jonathan Schell essay that I read, the one that's in the June 19th issue of The Nation. Sadly, it's not available online, just the first paragraph. But what you can do, if you go to thenation.com, there, find the article, Jonathan Schell. And the title is Torture and Truth, Jonathan Schell, S-C-H-E-L-L. If you get to the article, there is, I think there's a coupon there where you can get four issues of The Nation as a trial subscription, maybe no charge. I'm not sure. It just flashed in my mind that there was some sort of a special there to get people to subscribe. I've been a Nation subscriber since forever. And I know a lot of people listen to this program are. But if you're not, you might, and you want this Jonathan Schell article, you might just go to thenation.com. It's called Torture and Truth. It's in the June 15th issue of The Nation, which I think is one or two back, probably. And you can get it that way by taking their trial offer. I don't know if you can get back issues that way or not, but it's worth a try. It's Jonathan Schell. Remember, he was the person back in the 80s who was the first to really lay out what catastrophic thermonuclear war, where the result would be global winter because of all the debris that would be kicked into the air. And the radiation poisoning and the death and destruction and how we had within our grasp the power to destroy all life on Earth. Not some, not part, not just humans, but all life. And what that meant. I can't summarize it. It was just some of the most critically powerful, unnerving writing that I have ever read. The Fate of the Earth. I believe that was the title of it, The Fate of the Earth. It just drives an absolute icicle right into the center of your consciousness. It was one of the most powerful essays, although it was book form, essay on why nuclear weapons had to be somehow dismantled, destroyed, gotten rid of. How, well, you know, you either read it or you didn't. If you didn't read it, maybe you should. The Fate of the Earth. But he certainly is, if not the premier social philosopher, political philosopher, however you want to put it, that we have in this country. I don't know who would be. A lot of people say, well, Noam Chomsky. Well, not really. Chomsky has his, you know, his style, but it's certainly not Jonathan Schell. Jonathan Schell writes as a philosopher. Chomsky writes as a theoretician. Schell does not. So, to the people who are asking about this, how to get it, I wish it were available online, but only the first part of it is, and then you have to subscribe to the Nation. But you can get it. I think you can get 3 or 4 issues free. I like this. Sheila sends me an email under the subject line, More Good News. It says, the Obama administration is moving to appeal a ruling that some detainees at a military air base in Afghanistan can use U.S. civilian courts to challenge their detention. The Justice Department asked a federal appeals court Friday to hear its appeal on an expedited basis. The Justice Department told the appeals court that the ruling that said some of these detainees have a right to challenge their detention in U.S. courts, that ruling was an unprecedented order that extended constitutional rights to citizens of Yemen and Tunisia held by U.S. armed forces at Bagram Airfield in an active combat zone in Afghanistan. The judge had extended those rights previously given to terrorism detainees at the U.S. military prison in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. So what it means is the Obama administration is saying, no, these people do not have a right to challenge. There is no habeas corpus here. They do not have a right to challenge our continuing to hold them in detention indefinitely, forever, for as long as we want to. And I don't quite understand this, except on the basis of what I said, that this is a desire on the part of Barack Obama to protect himself and his family against murderous assassins who would come for him if he were to take the action that would say, look, we still are a nation of laws. We're going to allow these people to challenge their detention in court. I don't know anymore. I just don't know. I really don't. Do you? About 25 before the hour. Another reminder of what we're going to do tomorrow night. We're going to give away 2 free subscriptions to the Malloy podcast package. We're going to do that every Friday night for the next 5 weeks, and it's thanks to an anonymous donor who bought 10 of these specifically so we could give them away to listeners. And the way we're going to do it is tomorrow night on Friday, we'll have a trivia contest. Everybody loves trivia, right? When we announce it, you'll call in. We'll have three or four people online, and we will go to each person who is on hold and ask you a trivia question. They will probably mostly be multiple choice or complete the sentence or whatever. And they're all about Bush and the politics and so on and so forth. And if you get it right, that's it. You get the podcast gift subscription. We'll then put you back on hold, and Kathy will get the information so that we can get it entered for you. And we'll do that until we have two winners. And we'll do that each Friday night for the next 5 weeks. And again, thanks to the anonymous donor who made this possible. We really do appreciate it. He wants to be anonymous, so okay. That's cool. Michael in Roswell, New Mexico writes about President Obama's refusal to allow the hearings or investigations or photos or tapes or whatever to come out. Michael writes, hate to say it, but the resistance on Obama's part to exposure of the truth has nothing to do with limiting violence. This is about protecting the power structure that put him into office. He thinks that he can create change if he can stay in office, but if he tries to favor a power structure that commits crimes against humanity, what change can he expect? If Obama weren't concerned about the fate of that power structure and the false narrative it has created, we'd be seeing war crimes investigations and trials right now, up to and including that of George W. Bush, as law and international treaty require. We do torture. We have done so for decades. Our government endorses torture. We just want to imagine ourselves incapable of it, but the truth is quite the opposite. As a nation, we're the biggest believers of BS ever assembled in one place. Why wouldn't we elect someone who thinks he has a mandate to go on protecting the fantasies we entertain about ourselves? And yeah, the sick right wing calls that America hating. Michael in Roswell. Well, I guess that certainly is in competition for the real reason that there are no investigations, no hearings, no criminal probes. Michael's point of view that it is Obama's way to protect the power structure that put him into office. I've been told that. For so long now, not about Obama, but about any politician, no matter how genuine, no matter how sincere, no matter how dedicated, no matter how truthful, yada, 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 that when they get to that level of power, they are there to protect the power structure first and then see what they can do about maybe cleaning up some of the messes left by previous administrations. I've heard it and heard it and heard it. I hate to be your naive liberal talk show host, but it's very difficult for me to get to that point yet. How about you? I mean, seriously. Apparently Michael has gotten there. A lot of people have gotten there, and it's probably the more honest, intellectual place to stand. Yeah, come on, wake up. This is about protecting power. It has nothing to do with stopping violence against American soldiers. How in the hell do you stop violence against American soldiers in a goddamn war zone? We are being asked, I get this part, Michael, we are being asked to believe that there would be an increase in a war zone of violence if these photographs are revealed. That's insanity. I agree with that. That's madness. But that's the argument being put out there. And it's being put out as offhandedly as saying, well, we can't reveal to our enemy the inner workings of the CIA because then they'll know the inner workings of the CIA. I mean, it's just being said as though it's a matter of fact. That's the part that's maddening to me. We don't want our soldiers and Marines who are in a war zone fighting for their lives, killing or being killed, exposed to danger or violence? What the F does that mean? But that's the argument. So rather than look at that and say, yeah, well, that is, it's madness. It's mad. It really, this is not about lessening violence, potential violence against our soldiers. No, it has nothing to do with that. It is about protecting the power structure. Very easy, it should be, for anyone rational to make that move. Okay, yeah. So why can't I do it? I don't know. I have no idea. I have no idea. Can you do it? I mean, do you believe that? Do you believe what Michael just wrote? Do you believe it's about protecting the power structure? I certainly don't think it's about lessening the chance of violence against soldiers who are in a combat zone. I mean, just think for a moment here. Go ahead, because this goes in one ear and out the other most of the time during the day when we hear it on the news. Well, you know, the president's decided that these pictures would incite violence. Secretary of State says the same thing. The Secretary of Defense says the same thing. The head of the CIA says the same thing. They're all on the same page, and you and I sit back here, and when we listen to this garbage on CNN or MSNBC or wherever, and it goes in one ear, zoom, and right out the other, zoom. This will cause violence against our soldiers who are in a war zone, who are fighting for their lives, who are shooting and killing and being shot and being killed, but this will incite violence? Man. Alan is calling from Miami. Hi, Alan.
Hi. Yeah, I just want to suggest, first of all, that there's a program I recently saw on PBS. It was kind of amazing. You can still find it at pbs.org. It was called We Shall Remain. Are you familiar with that?
It's called what?
We Shall Remain.
No, I'm not.
It was amazing. And it was a five-part series, an hour and a half long each, so 7.5 hours, about the history of Native Americans through the eyes of Native Americans. And I think everybody should watch that if they want to see how long our history goes with betrayal and torture and pain and attacking people and then promising one thing and giving something else. It's an amazing thing that the fact that it even came out. It was a five-part series. The fifth part was about Wounded Knee, the recent event in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And it shows how they made, because that one was covered by TV. The rest was sort of reenacted, first with historians and anthropologists speaking, and a lot of Native American descendants were in it. It's an amazing program. It's wonderful. Mm-hmm. We Shall Remain.
Okay.
And it relates to the kind of stuff that's happening today, I believe. The idea that this violence, say, is going to somehow stop. I mean, all we're doing is we're giving reasons for new people to want to attack us and to fight back. But what, the point I wanted to say is that these people who are doing this are the very image of evil. This is the hell that people talk about, that you would have leaders that would gather up folks and do this to them in the name of whatever. And so it seems to me all the religious folks who are out there and talk about the justifications for the wars and defending the United States, I don't think anybody's really looking at what adds to our security here. I don't think if anybody, and this is what disturbs me about how the Democrats have been acting in Congress, even before they had the Congress, it would be easy to disprove that any of these policies increase our security. Mm-hmm. There's no way to prove that it does. They can only affirm it. There's no way to prove it.
Right.
In fact, you can pretty well show that it does the opposite. But the idea of doing these horrible things to people and not caring about it, mm-hmm. it are the very demons of hell upon us.
Yeah,
and
for sure.
We are letting them run the nation ragged, and our leaders are bowing down to it. It's we have to stand up, as you say. It's if America is to save its soul, we must face mm-hmm. this
yeah.
and face it fully, or we have nothing to offer the world ever again.
Yeah, and yeah. Well said, Alan. Thank you. I appreciate your putting it that way. I don't know how to do that either. You know, I agree with everything Alan says. I agree with what Jonathan Schell says. I agree with what a lot of people email this program say. Yeah, it has to be exposed. If there is any attempt going to be made to either reclaim or establish, I don't even know there's anything to reclaim, but to establish that this nation believes in the rule of law. This nation does have a moral sense, or, if you will, a soul. Did I just say, if you will? Oh, my God. That we have a soul, that the nation has a soul. And you know what I mean by that. A collective awareness, a collective consciousness, a Jungian overarching idea. Oh, never mind. We'll be right back.
No, no, don't do that. Oh, don't do that. It takes a lifetime to learn what's been lost. Why are we all fighting? Oh, why do we keep on lighting these fires, these bombs? We don't know what's gone wrong, forgetting where we've come from, and all of this violence is...
Thanks to the crew. The crew is Ben Burch, Sharon Gordy, Bob Alexander, Bridget Wolf, Bruce Enberg, and Catherine Day. And a couple of our more diligent listeners have found how to get to Jonathan Schell's article without essay, without subscribing to The Nation. Sorry, Nation. Go to truthout.org, truthout.org. And on their search engine, just type in torture and truth, and the whole thing is there. Truthout, truthout.org. Aren't you familiar with that? Truthout.org. And on their on-site search engine, type in torture and truth, and the whole thing is there. Thanks to Reg and Kathy who found it. All right. You guys are just too good. To your phone calls. A hack is calling from Missouri, listening on Sirius. Hey, hack.
Hey, Mike. What's going on?
You are. How's the trip tonight?
Oh, it's there.
Okay.
It's there.
Good.
Yes. Well, you know, it kind of brings me back to being in the Army. I was in the Army for 15 years, and if there's anything that I learned that's pertinent to the it's pertinent to think about the torture photos, torture memos.
Uh-huh.
Personally, I'm kind of torn about. I'm kind of two minds about the torture photos, but I think the lesson here is that number one, a standard is much easier to maintain than it is to establish.
Yeah.
Number two, if you've established a standard and you don't keep up that standard, it's as though you've set a new standard.
Okay. Yeah. That makes sense. Sure. Sure.
And as far as President Obama's reversal on the release of the photos, I think somebody gave him a stern talking to that, the standard CIA thing.
Well, it wasn't just CIA. You're right. I mean, it was Panetta, the CIA. It was also Odierno, who is now in charge of troops in Iraq, and also Petraeus, who's in charge of Odierno. And McChrystal, the guy who is now in charge of Afghanistan, you know, Petraeus got kicked up, and these other guys, these other generals now, they have to deal with the fighting on the ground. So everybody seems to be on the same page that these photos can't be released. But you get my point. You were in the service. You understand my point. When you have people in a combat situation, how in the hell are photographs going to increase the potential for violence against them? Are they referring to if they're captured?
I don't. Probably so. Probably so. I really don't have an answer for you on. I really don't have an answer for you on that one.
Right.
But you know, I was thinking more of the standard two-word CIA explanation, as in John Kennedy.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I get you. All right, Hank.
I don't envy President Obama. I don't envy him a bit. He's in a hell of a fix.
Yeah.
Or he's in a hell of a position.
Yeah, You're absolutely right. Thanks, man. I appreciate it. Take care. Drive safe. Drive safe, Hack. Max is in Sacramento. Hey, Max.
Hey, Mike. How you doing?
I'm all right. How are you?
Good. Yeah, I've been watching all the news lately with Dick Cheney on the TV talking about all this classified information, and then his daughter is usually along with him. I'd like to know what role she had in the federal government and how much security clearance she has.
He got her a job, I think, in the State Department. She was a special envoy or something. I get your point. This is ridiculous. This woman is out there with her dad now, reinforcing his lies, establishing her own, and totally corrupting, whatever discussion. Of course, anything that comes out of Cheney's mouth is a corruption. So,
right.
I'm not sure why she's there other than to, protect, and defend her father. But she did have a position in the Bush administration. I think it was in the State Department. It might have been in the Defense Department. I'm not sure, but whatever it was, her appointment was like in the old Soviet Union, where they would place a political operative in every single branch of government so that the operative could report back to the Kremlin exactly what was going on, so that there would be not even the beginnings of dissent, no matter what it was. The Bush administration did this. They did it with every single department, every cabinet office, and I think that's what Cheney's daughter was. She was the eyes and ears for her old man, and now she's out here with and that gave her the clearance necessary so she could get in there and sniff around, and now she's out here defending her father.
Yeah, well, you know, I was in the military, and I had secret clearance on a need-to-know basis.
Right.
You know, and I'm sure, you know, what they're talking about is top secret, you know, on a need-to-know basis.
Right.
You know, so what gives her the right to, you know?
I know. Oh, no, I hear you. I hear you. It just, it's crazy. I don't have any words for it. I'm never at a loss for words, but about this stuff, Max, I don't know where in the hell to begin.
Yeah,
I don't know what to say. It every night when I'm getting ready to do the program here, I think there's nothing sensible that's going to come out of my mouth because I am just screwed to the ground, just like most of us. I just sit here and go, what?
Yeah, and what gets me is nobody's challenged her.
Yeah, that's true. Hey, listen, thanks, Max.
Okay,
all right, pal. Take care. We are out of time, ladies and germs. So we're going to pack it in for tonight, and see you tomorrow night. Don't forget, tomorrow night we're going to do this this trivia thing that should be a lot of fun. And thanks to our anonymous donor who contributed 10 paid for podcast subscriptions. So we're going to give away two of them tomorrow night. You can become a podcast subscriber very cheaply, 25 cents a program. Just go to MikeMolloy.com and you'll get the information. Remember, science flies you to the moon, religion flies you into buildings. I'll see you tomorrow night. Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Molloy.